Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello, and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is General Amanda Reyes. Hi, Amanda. Welcome back.
Hi, thank you. I'm a general. It's very exciting.
You've been on the show every season, plus the live table read. I'd have no more ranks. I guess I could do 1 star and 2 star or 3 star, but you've risen through the ranks and you've earned it. You've earned that that rank, Amanda.
Thank you so much. But if you want to give me stars, I'll take them.
Okay, fair enough. I think you could do 4 star is the most you can be. So we got like 5 seasons. We'll work it out. But yes, I always enjoy having you on the show. And so I'm really excited to talk about this episode from season 6, which is the 19th episode, What's Up, Doc? A really, really funny show. And we'll get into all the details of it, of course, in a moment. But since this is your first time on season 6, I've been asking everybody as they come on for the first time, what's your general feeling about the Winchester years now that we're here?
You know, I love Winchester, and I like Frank Burns a lot, and I really like the actor who played Frank Burns. I love Larry Linville. He's great, but I feel like he got sort of written into a corner, and he's not somebody that I felt like could have been redeemed properly on the show, not the way Margaret would be later or right. is now, but Winchester feels like kind of a happy compromise, like for where I think they thought the corner was for Frank Burns and where they could go with Winchester. And so they gave him a bigger feel to move around in the character and to grow and stuff. And he's great. He's not completely unlikable, but he is really snooty and all this stuff. And he's really fun. And I think as the series progresses, I'm thinking of a couple episodes where he really stands out. The one where his sister stutters is a great one.
Oh, yeah, it's a great one, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of heart there that wasn't there with Frank. And he's really great. And David Ogden Steers is a wonderful actor. And I remember being a kid and watching Winchester and then seeing a TV movie, which I don't know if you're familiar with. It's called Circle of Children.
No, I've not seen that one.
It's a true story about this woman who was a socialite who ended up becoming like a teacher for kids who had learning disabilities. And some of them were very severely autistic. And David Ogden Steers plays one of her co-teachers and also has like a romantic interest in her. And he has dropped that like snooty accent. He's just, you know what I mean? It's like a totally mm-hmm. different person. And I remember being a kid and being really blown away by that because he was so much in that character of Winchester for me that I couldn't envision him being any other way. And then he plays this beautiful, wonderful character in this film. And even as like a 9-year-old, I was like, wow, this guy's fantastic. So yeah, I'm a big fan.
That's great. I've never even heard of that. When was that? Was that during his MASH years or before?
I believe it was, that's a good question. I think it was either right before or somewhere at the beginning of. I can't remember where Circle of Children came out because I saw it in reruns as a kid, but I would say either right before or right at the beginning.
Oh, that's great. I'll have to check that out. That sounds wonderful. I love it when he would show up and stuff. You know, I would get like Better Off Dead. He's the dad in Better Off Dead. You know, I mean, it's about as far away from Winchester as it could be, but I remembered seeing that movie and I was like, oh, I'm just so happy to see Winchester.
Yeah,
in a John Cusack movie.
So great. He just had this great depth and there's something about him that's really likeable. And I think that's another thing about Winchester is that even when he's being snooty and kind of jerky, there's something inherently likable about the actor that I think keeps you with him. You know, and with Frank Burns, it wasn't there, even though I love him, mm-hmm. you know, but it's mm-hmm. a different kind of love, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, okay. Well, let's talk about this episode. It's called, as I said, What's Up, Doc? It first aired on January 30th, 1978. It was written by Larry Balmaggia and directed by George Tyne. During a session in OR, everyone seems to notice how snippy Margaret is acting. She gets frustrated at every joke Hawkeye utters and puts a nurse on report for a petty mistake. After surgery, Hawkeye asks her what's the problem, and after some cajoling, she admits she's irritated because she might be pregnant. Hawkeye is ecstatic, but Margaret is not. Her and Donald Penobscot are not exactly getting along, and if she is pregnant, her whole army career, as she puts it, kaput. She's not positive she's pregnant, though, so Hawkeye helps her go about getting a test. Meanwhile, a patient of BJ's named Lieutenant Martinson is furious over the idea of being sent back into battle. Because of his education, he was made an automatic lieutenant, put in charge of other men. But some of them were killed due to his lack of experience. He flat out refuses to go back into combat. BJ tries to console him, but Martinson will accept nothing less than being relieved of his command. Hawkeye and Margaret turn to Colonel Potter and tell him the news, and he is equally happy. They decide a pregnancy test is the next step, so they turn to the owner of the nearest rabbit they can find, which was, of course, Radar. But when Radar is told that his beloved rabbit Fluffy has to die during the procedure, he is horrified, refuses, and storms out. Hawkeye catches up with Radar, who it seems has let Fluffy free from her cage. Radar asks, can't Hawkeye just remove the rabbit's ovaries, the part of the rabbit that they will test? Hawkeye says it's possible, but since Fluffy is now gone, what's the point? At that point, Margaret produces Fluffy out of his jacket, tentatively handing her over to Hawkeye, who promises to care for her as best he can. While Hawkeye and Margaret perform the surgery, Lieutenant Martinson gets angrier and angrier at BJ. Winchester tries to relate to him, Ivy Leaguer to Ivy Leaguer, but that doesn't work either. Martinson then pulls a gun and takes Winchester hostage, demanding a chopper home. This standoff crosses over into the OR, where Hawkeye and Margaret have finished the operation on Fluffy and are about to perform the pregnancy test. But Martinson demands they all leave. Klinger, upon hearing Martinson wants a flight back to Ohio, volunteers to replace Winchester as hostage. Instead of being scared, Klinger is downright gung-ho about their prospects. But Martinson, weak from his wound and lack of sleep, can barely stand. In fact, he passes out just as the chopper arrives, dashing Klinger's hopes of freedom. Later, Hawkeye and Margaret do the pregnancy test, and it's negative. Margaret is happy, but Hawkeye admits he's a little disappointed. Margaret then pauses and admits, so am I. All right, Amanda, you asked for this episode in particular. So before we get to the sort of scene-by-scene breakdown of it, why did you want to talk about this one?
Well, I love animals. I see a lot of myself on Radar, I think, in this episode. And I remember being a kid and watching this and being kind of terrified about what they were going to do to Fluffy, just like Radar is. Yep. And I love the idea of them saving Fluffy, like actually doing a little surgery, which is kind of adorable when they're kind of doing it, you know, and then they put the bandage on her and everything, and everything about it was like, for like 9-year-old me, was like wonderful. And it always stuck out in my head. Like there's some really great episodes of MASH, like very serious, groundbreaking episodes, but like this as a kid just warmed my heart that they were so compassionate enough towards Radar's love of this rabbit that they would actually make an attempt to save it. And then, as an adult, there's like extra layers to it. And I don't know if we'll go in depth on it, but one of the things that I really like about this episode now as a grown woman is this idea that Margaret doesn't necessarily want to have a baby, when television was so much steeped in this idea of family and like having babies was always portrayed as being the super positive thing. And she brings up two really good points, why maybe this pregnancy might not be right for her at this time. And that's, you know, of course, she'd have to give up her career. And also she fully understands in 1950s Korea that having a baby isn't necessarily going to save a marriage. Right. And that was a common thing that happened with a lot of couples. And so it's actually got a lot of stuff going on in it that I really appreciated. And I forgot that Martinson was played by Charles Frank, who is an actor that I really love. And he made a lot of TV movies in the 70s and stuff. And he was really cool. So it's got a lot going on in it that I just really like and that maybe resonates with me.
Mm-hmm. It's also very funny. You know, I rewatched it for the purposes of this show, like, and I'm writing down jokes. I'm like, God, there's a lot of great jokes in this show on top of everything you just said. And I also, you know, I've said this in previous episodes. I love it when on MASH, the A plot and the B plot merge into the one plot. I always find that to be, just really good writing as opposed to kind of, you know, later episodes where they would do A plot and B plot and they were just completely disconnected. Not that that's a fatal flaw, but I just find it to be more kind of cinematic and it feels more like a complete meal, like a beginning, middle, and end when these two separate events dovetail. And they cross over. Is that all this stuff going on with Martinson spills over into the surgery and the secrecy, of course, that Margaret wants to keep it secret because she doesn't want everyone to know what she's doing. And regarding the stuff with, you know, Margaret and family planning and like, yeah, this show is set in the 50s, but it's made in 1978. We're not that far from women's lib. We're not that far from Roe versus Wade. It's, you know, that's a modern problem. That's a problem that 1970s women are dealing with. And here it is, Margaret dealing with, you know, and so it couldn't be more current, even though the show was set in 1952 or whatever. So it really is like a perfect melding of what was going on at the time. And also, you know, the realities of, yeah, Margaret would have to give up her army career. And as we know from this season, Donald Penobscot's terrible. He's just a terrible guy. You know?
Yeah.
The last thing they want is to have a baby. I mean, just absolutely, you know, the wrong long time.
It's kind of interesting. So there's this TV movie that Loretta Swit was in called The Love Tapes, which is sort of like it's kind of like a Love Boat, but in that it's sort of an anthology of three or four different stories happening at once about this computer dating service. And Loretta Swit plays a single mother who is looking for a spouse because she's having a really rough time raising a kid by herself. And she ends up meeting this guy who's really nice and he really likes her and he loves her kid. He's really into kids. And every date they have is like the kid is involved and they go play baseball and they go to museums and parks and everything. But he seems to really be in love with the idea of the kid and having a family more so than he is in love with Loretta Swit's character. And so she has to make this decision. And I'll be just a little spoilery here, but I think it ties into this. And she has to decide whether or not she wants to marry somebody who maybe will provide for her, but isn't going to be like the love of her life. Or is she going to hold on and wait, even though she's struggling to raise this kid by herself? So I won't give away the ending. But what I like so much about this, and I thought about this when I was watching this MASH episode for this podcast, is that I don't know that Loretta Swit gets a lot of credit for what she did as Margaret Houlihan, but her TV movie career is really fucking amazing. And I don't know if I can curse on here, but, she was really progressive and groundbreaking in a lot of ways. And I think that that TV movie, which is really rare and hard to find, unfortunately makes a really good companion, I think, with some of the choices that Margaret is making on the show. And when I was watching this, I kept thinking, gosh, she's such a goddess. Like, she was really taking these brave choices in her characters. And I really appreciate it. And you're right, it is in the middle of women's lib and stuff, but like so much of television was like, you can have it all, but you can have a career and a marriage and you should have both. Like, they still weren't letting us rip away from this idea of being single and independent in a lot of ways. And she was like seeking out these different kind of opportunities and options for women. And she's just amazing. That's it. I'm done gushing.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, by the nature of the fact that she's the only female cast member on the show,
yeah,
the only one, every female-centric storyline she has to carry the burden of. You know, yes. They didn't get to spread it around. I mean, yes, there's the one episode out of 251 episodes on Nurse Kelly. There's that one, which we'll get to in 5 years. But every time these writers, which of course are predominantly going to be men, have an idea for a, you know, quote unquote women's story, Margaret has to be the one who does it because there's no other female characters to kind of distribute. I mean, yeah, they would do little bits and pieces with some of the other nurses, but generally it's all on Loretta Swit for 11 solid years.
Yeah.
That's a huge burden to carry on a show, you know, this good and stuff. But I mean, I'm sure she was happy to get stuff to do. But, you know, yeah, that's a lot for her. And now I want to see this Love Tapes. That sounds fantastic, too.
It's great. Well. It's really good. But that's the storyline that always stood out to me. And I feel like it's a really important one, you know?
Yeah.
And she's just amazing. And I just love her. I'm going to stop there. I could go on forever.
Fair enough. So, okay. Well, so the show opens up in surgery and Hawkeye is being kind of extra goofy. He's pretending he hits on one of the nurses and then he's pretending to be Sherlock Holmes and he hits on the one nurse and she's like, you know, sorry, Sherlock. And he's like, oh, you know, another night with my pipe and my dirty robe. And he's just kind of being very typical Hawkeye, nothing really that unusual. But of course, Margaret, as we'll learn, is in a really bad mood. He makes a joke about, you know, welcome to Who Bet Your Life. And she's like, will you cut it out? And there's nothing to joke around here. And then Potter even sort of steps in and says, you know, lighten up. It's okay. You know, we can joke around. And, you know, she kind of ignores that a little, even though he's, you know, obviously the commander and he's sort of telling her. One little detail that I feel like I have to point out just because I'm a nerd about this stuff is when we see OR scenes, right, and they want to convey that it's really busy. There's lots of ambient noise that they put in on the soundtrack later on. You hear clinking of instruments. There's more noise than probably four doctors can generate, right? If you listen closely, right before Colonel Potter says, he turns to the nurse and he asks for a lap sponge, right before that, if you listen closely, you will hear the voice of Trapper John. And that is something they did on the show across the years where they would just layer in, I guess the sound editor would layer in ADR from other episodes because they wanted the room to sound busier than it was. And once in a while, I would hear a voice and I'd go, that sounds like Henry Blake. And I'm looking at, but if this is the one time where you really hear it, you hear Trapper. And I know you're a fan of late period Trapper with your trap guest. But I just found that fascinating that, yeah, you can hear the voice of long gone Trapper John still.
That's so watch. Amazing. And funny, when you said Trapper John, my first thought was Pernell Roberts and not Wayne Rogers. So I was like, wow, Pernell Roberts. And then I was like, oh no, wait, that's not what he means. That would have been amazing though.
That really would have been amazing. How far are you along on Trap Guest, by the way?
Not far at all. I have such a hard time with my podcast right now because I've just been so busy. I'm like on season one, episode 11, and I've written like several scripts. I just haven't had time to record them. I'll get to
it. I love it. So Colonel Potter tells some story about World War One and, you know, Hawkeye joking around. And so then this one patient is kind of fighting back a little. Like the nurse is trying to put him under, and he's fighting off, and then the nurse is trying to, and she's like, you know, and Margaret's like, you know, come on, you know, I think she says Baker. There's always different nurses playing Nurse Baker. And she yells at her, and the nurse can't quite get it. And BJ is about to step in, and Margaret jumps in and she says, if your doctor has to do your job for you, he'll have to re-glove. And she, you know, the nurse says, I'm sorry, Major. And even BJ steps in and is kind of like, it's all right. It's fine. And, you know, and then she says, Baker, you're on report. And the nurse says, for this, you're kidding. And then Margaret says, and no, and adding talking back to a superior officer. And I love you hear the whole room go, oh, just like, Margaret, now come on. And so we know something's wrong because Margaret is just being completely, you know, ridiculous here.
Yeah. I mean, she's past the ridiculous stage of her character. So it's, although they do bring out, you'll get to it later when she talks about like, well, I've been irritable. And Hawkeye says something like, well, then you've been pregnant since I've known you.
One of the best lines. By the way, the nurse playing the actress playing the nurse is Loris Foraker. She's been on the show before. This is her fourth MASH playing. She's always playing a different nurse. And this is her last one. This is her last appearance and on the show. So then we're in post-op and Margaret, we see is looks like she's almost crying. She's so upset. And Hawkeye tries to help her out. She doesn't want any. And she's like, why don't you just leave me alone? And he's like, oh, yeah, the way you learn. Oh, he says Nurse Bell. Excuse me, not Baker. He says the way you left Nurse Bell alone. And he says, what's wrong with you? You're too good to go after such a nitpicky mistake, which I think is a great. He's trying to soften her up by complimenting her.
Yeah.
Which I think is great. And that's true. You know, it's like, hey, you know, she doesn't go after. She's not Frank Burns. You know, she knows when to exert pressure and when not. And so then they kind of, you know, she says, you know, okay, can we talk for a minute? And then she says, I was with Donald and 6 weeks ago in Tokyo. And then she says, I think that I, and I love how long it takes her to get this out. I'm pretty sure that I'm pregnant. Of course, Hawkeye explodes. He's happy. You mean with child? And he's gritting from ear to ear. And of course, he's not picking up the fact that she's less than happy about this news.
I like that though, because he brings up the point about how where they are is just so full of, it's so bleak. And here is something that's celebrating like life. And it's such a genuine response. And I also like that she's like kind of one of the gang now because she's confiding in Hawkeye and it feels like they've really established like a nice friendship and trust. And so I think it's a really sweet moment too, because he's like happy, but also like he's really quickly in tune with like why she's unhappy.
Yeah, absolutely. They're genuine friends at this point. I mean, it's a little tense, but they're, you know, she is confiding with him. I mean, really, when you think about it, outside Colonel Potter, who we'll find out about all this in a minute, who else is she really going to confide in? There's no one else at her level, outside of Hawkeye. You know what I mean? Like obviously he's a goofball in her eyes and whatever, and he's a captain, not a major, but in terms of their intellectual level, despite of his childlike behavior, she knows that he's the real deal. And so she can confide in him. And that's great. I love that they did that. And so then she sits him down and says, you know, Captain, you know, Donald and I are not getting along, and this isn't going to help solve our problems, is only going to add to them. And then he's like, well, you sure? And she's like, you know, that time of the month hasn't been that time of the month. And that was last month. And I got to say, when I was a kid and I watched it, I didn't know what the hell she was what she was talking about, but I was seven, you know. I was just like, okay, all right, whatever. I don't know about what the rules were for television. It was still pretty restricted. I would imagine that that still wasn't something that was talked about on sitcom.
Not to my knowledge. And, you know, I didn't even think about it when she said it. And I you still don't hear it a lot on television.
No, you still don't.
Think. I mean, there's that famous Roseanne episode where Darlene gets her period.
Yeah.
And John Goodman's character is like really uncomfortable, but he's trying to be a good dad. It's a really great episode. But that's the only time I can recall it really being approached in any way. But I'm sure that there have been characters that said I missed, or I guess they would say I skipped. They probably wouldn't say the phrase period. They would probably find a way around it.
Yeah.
But I can't recall. That's a really interesting. There must be an article about that, like the progression of like talking about those kinds of things on television, but I hadn't thought about it.
Yeah. I mean, All in the Family was the first show to have a flushing toilet. And that was 1972. You know, I mean, that's only 5 years before this.
Wow.
I mean, it's, you know, I mean, you think about that now, what they show on television. So, Hawkeye says, let's go talk to Colonel Potter. So then they head out and then we're in post-op, and PJ is talking to Lieutenant Martinson, played by, as you already mentioned, Charles Frank. He was on lots of TV, guest episode appearances on Lois and Clark, Hearts of Fire, Matlock, Life Goes On. He played one of the astronauts in The Right Stuff, which is perfect because he looks like an astronaut.
Yeah.
You know, he's a classically handsome leading man. And yeah, you said he's been in a lot of TV movies.
Yeah, he is. He's in a really great movie called Ski Lift to Death, which has got a really amazing cast, including
title.
Yeah, Deborah. Oh my God, what's her name? I love her so much. No, I can't think of her name. She was in Nightmare in Bottom County. She's in Deborah Raffin.
Okay.
And Clute Gallagher, I think, is in it. And it's an early performance with Don Johnson. And it's got this really great, like, they can't have a wet t-shirt contest. So they have something like a tight sweater contest. It's like, it's very TV. And it's a disaster movie and it's really fun. And he was in, it's not a TV movie, but he's in one of my favorite Columbos with Ruth Gordon. He plays the victim in Try and Catch Me, which is a really great episode. And of course, he was in Tarantula as the Deadly Cargo. Which is a great, nature run amok made for TV movie. And he showed up in everything. And you're right. He's classically handsome. He's got this kind of all American thing happening, but he's also like a really good actor. Every time he shows up in something, I'm like, okay, Charles Frank's here. It's going to be cool. You know what I mean? he's great. I've always really liked him.
The one other credit that he has that I just left out was, of course, this is his second appearance on MASH. He was in the Dear Sigmund episode from season 5. He's the pilot who is bombing people and really doesn't regard what he's doing as particularly notable. And Hawkeye is the one that kind of drags him into the OR so he can see one of the small children that he's been bombing. And as you said, he's terrific in that episode. I mean, that Dear Sigmund is one of my, like, I'd say top 5 favorite MASH episodes, and he's great in it. The scene of him in the post-op where he realizes what he's been doing and he starts to cry and even says to, you know, Hawkeye, you know, you're a real son of a bitch, you know, and it's a great moment. And so I love it that he's back. You know, obviously he's a different character, but I think that's true. I wish he'd come back more often because he's a terrific actor.
Yeah. And this is kind of the polar opposite of that, because here he's deeply affected by what's happened, you know, on the field. And so it's really interesting.
So he talks to BJ about, you know, he says that piece of shrapnel you removed from my shoulder, it's what's left of my sergeant's helmet. He was right next to me when the mine went up. And he says, I'm not going back. I won't go back. And, you know, for all the several dozen, maybe more than that, storylines MASH did of different, you know, why one soldier doesn't want to go back, one he's scared of dying or whatever. This is something they would do a couple of times, but it's still fairly unique of that this guy. This is not someone remotely prepared for the assignment they've given him. And it's only because of his education that the Army immediately made him an officer and put him in charge of people when he is not ready for this. And the idea that it's not that he doesn't want to go back to combat because he's afraid, of course, but of course he is. I mean, who wouldn't be? But it's because he simply can't live with the idea that he's getting men killed.
Yeah.
What a great beat for this actor. You know, what a great storyline of the idea of it's not that if you're from my own life, it's I'm getting men killed and I can't live with that. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really, it's, and it must have been like just a little bit after Vietnam and stuff, deeply resonant with a lot of people kind of coming off their own sort of PTSD from that war. And I think it really speaks to like so many things. Yeah, it really, and it's interesting in this episode because you say it's a really funny episode, and even his stuff gets funny towards the end, mm-hmm. but the premise of his character doing the things that he does is not funny at all, you know, and it's kind of haunting when you think about it.
Yeah. And at one point he yells, he says, "I don't have what it takes to lead men into combat," which is a great bit of self-awareness. You know, I mean, most people want to think of themselves, especially in this context when it was only just men serving in the war. You want to think of yourself as brave, you know, and you're capable. But this is a guy who realizes, no, I'm not ready for this. And again, that takes a lot of self-actualization to have. And BJ, you know, tries to kind of comfort him, and he's not having it. You know, he basically says, "Leave me alone." And Winchester notices this, and he tries to make a joke. He says, "You know, your bedside manner failing you, Honeycutt." And BJ's like, "Lay off, Winchester." And Winchester's not getting it. And he says, "You know what? It's that the till of the pun has lost his sense of good humor." And BJ just says, "Drop it, Charles," and walks out. And it's terrific. It's a great moment of, like, BJ's like, "I'm just not in the mood for this. This is Winchester's picking the exact wrong time to try and be funny."
Yeah. And is he ever funny?
So we are then in the mess tent, and Colonel Potter has got a piece of mail where he has received a package of honey from his wife back in the States. I guess honey is maybe a little hard to get over here in Korea. So we see he's literally cutting it open like it's a bag of cocaine, and he's Scarface or something, and he's lowering it into his tea. Klinger shows up, and, you know, they're talking about all the packages coming over and mail order. And he says, "I got a mail order atomizer perfume and it got smashed," and stuff like that. And so they're just kind of commiserating a little bit as to what that's all about. And then there's this bit where Klinger has another scam where he talks about that he's got children at home that he needs to take care of. In fact, 9 children. And he's showing pictures. And of course, Potter is immediately not falling for any of it. And he says, "Who's the mother?" "Mothers." And he says, "I've finally given in to my tortured conscience, and I decided to take full financial responsibility." And then we're going to learn that these kids are photos that he's been grabbing from various people across the, including a photo of Colonel Potter's own grandchild.
Now, can we talk about the math of this scene? Because he says, like, "This kid's 19. And so that means you would have been 11 when you had him, which would have made Klinger 30.
Klinger is 30.
And I'm not buying it. And I think the actor was 44. I think I read that. But, like, when he did that particular episode. But I was like, and he looks great for 44. But, like, you know how we always say, like, people used to look older?
Yeah.
You know, because they smoked and everything. And it was like, well, he definitely looks older than 30. But that blew my mind. But it made sense. And I guess in the context of, they were talking about, he 44 would have been too old to be in the military at that point.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess it makes sense. But I instantly did the math when he said that. And I'm like, wait a minute, 30? That can't be right. Where am I messing up? Where am I not carrying my one? And I'm like, no, wait, this is so weird. And I find that people have gotten stuck on that.
Even 30 is old for a corpsman. They wouldn't really be drafting Corman at 30 years old. But yeah, Jamie Farr had one of those faces, and because he acts so goofy, that, like, you squint hard and you could buy that he's 24, maybe, you know. He doesn't look it, but he acts like a kid.
He does,
you know. Yeah, so you're definitely, like, yeah, maybe he's just one of those guys that, I mean, the example that you just mentioned about how people seemed older back then, the one that always blows my mind is when I think about that, when Christopher Reeve played Superman, he was 25 years old. I'm like, I look at that, I'm like, Superman was half the age I am now. I can't wrap my head around that he was essentially a child when he made that movie, and yet he was Superman. You know, I'm like,
yeah,
people just looked older back then.
They just did. So, like, when teenagers played teenagers in like slashers, a lot of them would be like young early 20s, but they looked 25, and it became a big joke. But it's just how we looked, you know. But Klinger, that was a tough one.
I mean, he's not even close to 30, you know. It's not like Gary Berghoff, who was like, I think he was like 26 and he's playing 18. I mean, you know, he's Jimmy Farr is a full decade and a half older than the character he's playing. But okay. So, So then we're back into Colonel Potter's office, and Margaret is waiting, and she's pacing. And there's this great moment where she says, "What's keeping that old coot?" And that's right at the moment that Potter walks in. He goes, "The old coot's here." And of course, she feels terrible. And he goes, "I know, I know. It was said with affection," which is so sweet. I've said this on a bunch of so many, you know, episodes. Their dynamic is so wonderful. There really aren't a lot of male female friendships on TV, you know? Yeah. And there were some father figures, but there aren't that many when they're not blood relation. Right. You know, and here they are. And I just think it's so sweet. I love that he just loves Margaret. And even when she's kind of being nasty, he still just kind of reassures her. It's all right. It's all right.
I get it. Yeah. Rapport between the actors here is really solid. It's really built itself up over the last few seasons.
Yeah. It's wonderful. So she mentions that she's pregnant. And of course, Potter is happy. He says, "Zippity doo dah!" And Hawkeye's like, "I used wonderful, wonderful miracle." And then there's this delicate moment where he goes, "Did you tell Donald yet?" And she says, "No." And he pauses and he goes, "Should you?" And she's so insulted. Yes! Only he could get away with that. I'm just like, yeah? Okay, great. All right, let's
just to clear that up.
Just to clear out. It's great. He's so gentle with her. I find it so charming. So she explains, you know, she sort of stutters and she's like, Donald and I are not, you know, and Potter's like, I get it. And then, you know, Hawkeye says, well, then of course, if she is pregnant, she'd have to leave. And then Margaret says, isn't there some way around that? Can we just bend the rules a little bit? Well, Margaret, you are not a fan of bending the rules for any reason. But of course, when it comes for you, you want to bend the rules.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I didn't think of that.
It's like, and when it's you, it's always different, you know, when it's other people, but when it's you. And then Potter's like, no, you know, only if you could stay a little bit pregnant. And then he says, we'll be sorry to lose you. And of course, Hawkeye's like, wait a minute. We don't even really know that she's pregnant. And they talk about, we can do the test here, but we need a rabbit for that. And then they all kind of like, okay. And then they realize, oh, radar. Colonel Potter calls radar, and Hawkeye's like, wait a minute, that rabbit's his pet. He lives with it. He reads to it. You know, he'd marry it if it was the same religion. And of course, Colonel Potter's like, if it's a choice between the rabbit and our head nurse, you know, and they pitch this to radar very gently. And they have to explain to him about the surgery and the whole thing about taking the ovaries out. And he's like, Hawkeye has to say, we don't take all of her, we don't, you know, all of her under the microscope, just the ovaries. And Hawkeye needs a moment. Radar needs a moment to process this. And then he realizes what they're talking about, stands up and absolutely says no. And he even says that would be murder. And like you mentioned at the top of the show, this is one of those things that I love so much about Radar. I love animals too. You know, I have a deep, deep concern and affection for them, all kinds of animals. And it's one of the things I love about Radar is that even when he is faced with his colonel, a major, and a captain, in this instance, he's the expert and he feels comfortable saying, no, yeah, I don't care what the order is. I'm not doing it. And I love that he stands up for Fluffy like that.
Oh, I know. This is one of those episodes that I think must have produced some anxiety in me when I was little, because the idea of it, like the way Radar comes to the conclusion, I can actually see it in my head just with my eyes closed, like that kind of, oh, no, you know, and I like the realization. And it's like, and I think I felt that too, because I have a feeling when I watched this, I didn't really understand. As a matter of fact, I think my mom had explained to me about that phrase, did the rabbit die? It's just a horrifying, there's something about this episode that's like slightly suspenseful. And like when you get to the part about where, and I don't want to jump ahead of you, but where you think that he's let the rabbit go, like even as an adult, after I've seen this episode several times, I'm like, you know, you can't take a pet and release it out into the wild. It won't survive. And no. There's this kind of anxiety inducing moment in certain parts of this episode that just really hit me.
Yeah. He'd rather let the rabbit try to survive in the wilds of war-torn Korea than subject it to this. And I would do the same thing. You know, I would absolutely do the same thing. But I just, and this, there's going to be another moment like this for Radar later on in the season in the Dr. Winchester, Mr. Hyde episode, where when it comes to his animals, Radar's very, very carefully modulated awareness that he is a lowly corporal doesn't get in the way of him saying, no, these are my animals and I'm not letting this happen. Mm-hmm. I don't care. And I love that. I love that about the character. I think it's a wonderful trait. It's not, again, a trait you see a lot on television to this day still. But I just think I just love in that moment, he is like, no, I don't care, I mean, he worships Colonel Potter. He worships Hawkeye. We know this already. But when it comes to his rabbit, it's like, no, we're not doing it. And yeah, it would be murder in his eyes because they're, you know, they're willfully killing the animal just for a test. It seems like such a waste. But though anyway, and I love Hawkeye's exasperated look on his face when he's looking in the cage and he's like, I wish you hadn't done that. You know, he's genuinely kind of irritated. And then they explain it, and Radar's like, well, can't you just operate on him? And he's like, operate on a rabbit? I've never done that before. You know, well, why couldn't you do that? Well, all right. And then he pulls the rabbit literally out of his coat pocket.
So sweet.
And Hawkeye's like, you know, refers to him as a magician, basically. I saw your act, you know, which is terrific. It's such a sweet little, you know, animal there. It's just kind of hangs there like, okay.
Doesn't he have a pet squirrel too?
Yes, he does.
So cute.
That's great. So, and that's the act break, although not before Radar says, she still will be able to have kids, won't she? And even Hawkeye's like, Radar. Like, okay. All right. Let me go a little far. So then we come back and we're in surgery, and it is, I love the little puppet they made for the bunny rabbit, because you see like its ears poking out of just a little plush of blankets, and Alan Alda and Loretta Swit have to pretend that they are poking at this thing. And he even says, you know, oh, there's nothing to it. Tweezers.
Yeah, because... so cute. Yeah.
It's great. I mean, it is kind of funny. You think about it. Did Hawkeye read a book? I mean, what does he know about rabbit anatomy? I guess some of the internal organs are the same, but there's a reason why veterinarians are veterinarians.
Yeah, I don't know why. I guess I assumed he did things like that in school, maybe before they moved to people. I'm not really sure. Yeah, I was just happy that Fluffy was in good hands.
Yeah. So, we're back in post-op. We meet another patient, named Witkow. This is played by an actor named Kurt Anden. He was in TV shows like Dallas, Quantum Leap, and the John Ritter movie Hero at Large. He doesn't really factor into the plot really in any way. He's just talking to Winchester, and it's kind of just sort of killing time until we see BJ is talking to Martinson again. Martinson is demanding a trip home, and BJ is like, look, there's just nothing, you know, there's really nothing I can do for you. They're not going to allow that. You know, that's not going to be a good enough reason for you to be discharged. And then he finally sort of takes him aside and says, look, there's another way. And he says, I can recommend you for psychiatric observation. And Martinson doesn't want anything to do with it. He says, I'm not letting some headhunter get a hold of me and put my record that I'm nuts. And, you know, BJ's like, they're not there to label you, Tom. They're there to help you. And he isn't, you know, he's not listening to this. And then he mentions that he spent 4 years at Yale, which, of course, is music to Winchester's ears. He uses that as an excuse to get involved because he feels, of course, that he can relate to Martinson on a level that BJ cannot, because they are both, upper crust men. BJ
Ivy League.
BJ went. I mean, excuse me. BJ, of course, Winchester went to Harvard, and Martinson went to Yale. Anyone putting says, you know, I understand. Sometimes we have to abide by the riffraff we have to deal with. And he nudges towards BJ when he says, "He's such a dick."
He's got his moments.
And so he's talking to Martinson, and he's not really paying attention. Then Martinson is not listening. Martin, you could see it on Martinson's face that he's made this decision. And he says, can you hand me that bag? And Winchester hands it over, and he pulls out his gun, which I would think that they would confiscate.
Yeah, but it's such a great subtle moment, because it's almost like you recognize that he's gotten the bag, but I'm not thinking he's going to be pulling a gun out of it. Yep. I don't know what I was thinking. And because they're just in the middle of this conversation. And so when he pulls out the gun, it's sort of like, whoa. But I also like that they're not centering anything on it. But I like this idea of like confronting the stigmatization of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he's terrified of having something like that on his record. And we're getting better and better about confronting mental illness and dealing with it like at face value. But I think even in the 70s, like it was a thing that terrified people. It was like worse than him pulling a gun on somebody and holding them hostage, you know? And so I think it's this really interesting sort of like, it's almost like it's not an afterthought. I think it's there on purpose, but it's like just to introduce this idea of like, maybe if we didn't stigmatize mental illness, we can avoid situations like this. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. it's just sort of subtly introduced. And I really like that aspect.
Yeah. I mean, even with Sidney Friedman, you know, who yeah. probably can't handle every case, but yeah, the idea that this is what he would rather do. He would rather probably be sent to Leavenworth.
Yeah.
Than be marked, you know, and he even goes through the details, you know, he's labeled as paranoid. And that's what BG says. I'm not there to label you. And he's not listening. So he pulls the gun on Winchester and they go out into the compound. There's a great little beat where everyone is following them out. And then there's other people who have come out of their tent. You see they're in like their robes and stuff. Cause obviously it's late at night and they come out and Potter comes out. And when Harry Morgan walks into the compound, you know, he initially can't see what's going on because Martinson is behind Winchester. And then Winchester kind of moves to the side. Martinson says, are you the CO? And the minute Potter sees what's happening, he lowers his voice into like another register and he just goes, what do you think you're doing, son? And it's just, I think it's just a great subtle little moment where Colonel Potter is getting kind of his bearings because he's probably just woken up and he's like, you know, what's all the commotion? And then he sees this and he immediately kind of drops down into a more calming, but very yeah. firm. What do you think you're doing, son? Like, okay, I'm taking command of this because this guy's obviously out of control. This is a great little acting choice by Harry Morgan. There's so many different ways to play it. You know, he could yell it, he could whatever, but just the way he just says, I just think it's terrific.
Oh, it just shows great leadership, you yeah. know, that he's trying to like contain the situation and like, what's the word that I want to use? Of course, now I can't think of it, where you de-escalate. Thank you. I was thinking of every other word, but that, yeah, where you, he's trying to sort of de-escalate at least the panic. You know, and he does it instantly. And you're right, he's half asleep, but he just kind of like it kicks in and he's like, you know, I've run this place and this is the guy that works for me and he's under my command and I have to figure out what's happening and how to get him out of it.
Yeah, it's really great. Mulcahy shows up, tries to talk Martinson out of it, but Martinson's not listening. Potter says, you know, we'll get a chopper, but you got to wait here until morning. And he says, no, I want one now. And Potter's like, they don't have headlights. They can't fly at night. So that's the fastest it's going to be. And then Potter moves a little closer. There's a great gag, on behalf of Winchester where Martinson starts flailing a little bit and he's waving his gun and Winchester yells, get back. All of you, get back, get back. That's an order. And then he remembers himself and he gestures to Potter and he goes, that's an urgent request to you, sir.
Yeah, I really like that moment too. Yeah.
I just love that in that moment he realizes I outrank everybody but one person. So I can't.
Just to be clear, I'm not wearing you around.
That's an urgent request to use. That's a great line read by David Ogden Stiers. So then we're back in post-op and they are putting the finishing touches on Fluffy. And we see even Margaret's putting a Band-Aid on its rump, which is
so
adorable. And Radar can't stand to watch it. Like he can't even, and there's even a part where earlier on, Margaret's like, come on, you've seen hundreds of people operated on. And he's like, oh yeah, no, people bad stuff is not as bad as rabbit bad stuff.
So yeah, I agree.
You can't deal with it.
Yeah. I love all animals like you and I feel really like protective of them and bunnies are really sweet. And, it just, this episode so hits my heart.
Yeah,
Radar hits my heart.
Yeah, there's some woods behind our place here, and people have come to leave vegetables in a little spot right outside the woods, and the bunnies that are in the woods have learned, okay, there's a relatively rotating supply of vegetables being left for us, So they come out and they will literally sit there with carrots and you'll dip, 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 dip. And our dog Pippa, the minute she sees a bunny rabbit, now she's on a leash the whole time, but the minute she sees a bunny rabbit, she gets into stalker mode because she has that instinct in her. And I've never let her get anywhere close because I'm like, bunnies get a raw deal by nature. You know, they're like, they're everybody's prey. You know, they really, they're completely harmless creatures. You know, they just want to eat and make little bunny rabbits and that's all they do. And so every time Pippa does that, I roll my eyes at her because I'm like, Pippa, come on, you're not. And the rabbit is never in any danger. The rabbit is like, I see you coming. And I, you know, like the minute Pippa gets within 10 paces, the bunny just turns tail, disappears into the woods, and Pippa continues on her walk disappointed. But it's like, babe, you're never getting a bunny rabbit, so just live with it. So anyway, this is where our A and B plots converge, where Martinson got his gun. He spills into the OR just before Margaret is trying to help. And then she actually, before she leaves, she goes and she says, your shoulder's bleeding. Can I fix that for you? And he's like, no way. And just before she leaves, she tries to stop and grabs her specimen and he won't let her do it. And of course, that's got to be, you know, so frustrating because, you know, this is the whole thing she's doing for this is for this thing. And, you know, you don't want it to get knocked over or destroyed because this is kind of her one chance. Then they run out and she accidentally says, my specimen, she accidentally says that. And then she says, I mean, he's pulled a gun on Charles.
Yeah, I remember that. My secret. Oops, I mean.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, Charles. She has to pretend that she's concerned about Charles. Radar runs off to get a chopper. I love that he's clutching the bunny the whole time, which is great. It's really, very sweet. And then Klinger shows up. And of course, you know, he's like, did I hear Ohio? It's the siren call. I love his outfit that he's wearing. He's like a robe. And then like, I guess it's like, is that the thing you wear? I don't know what he's got on his head. It's some sort of, I don't know. It's like for rollers or something.
That's what I thought it was for. I've never slept with anything like that on my head, but I guess it's to soften your head when you have rollers or maybe to keep them from moving around too much. I don't know.
He's fully committed to this bit.
He is.
You know, like he wears this stuff when no one's around. Like, you know, no one's there for him to play act to, but he's still wearing this stuff. He comes running in. And, of course, Martinson is like, you know, did they send a chopper? No, he's like something better, me. And he explains that, you know, I'm your escape plan. I'm from Toledo. I can show you all sorts of places. Well, they'll never be able to find you. And of course, Winchester is like, take him. Immediately gives it up. I would be lost in Ohio. Take him, please. I've never been to Ohio. He was born and raised there. It's like, Charles.
I feel though that like I relate to him and his response to like when he gets out, and I know you're gonna get to that, but like, and they're like, how are you? And he's like, I'm fine. And he just passes out. And you're like, I feel like that's what I would have done.
Yeah. Like it's the stress of this has finally just, you know, crumpled him over where he just falls over and he just does a face forward and plants because he's dealing with the stress of all this. So BJ sort of catches up and he's, you know, basically says, you know, like he's beyond the point of talking. And then we're back inside and we see that Martinson, who is, we could see from his bandage that he is losing blood. And of course, this is presumably about like 5 a.m. So he's losing blood, losing sleep. He's barely conscious. But Klinger can't bear that because he feels like this guy is his meal ticket. So he's doing his best to keep Martinson awake. He's slapping him on the face. You know, come on, kid, don't do this to me. And then the chopper even arrives. He tells the chopper's here. We'll make no attempt to stop it. He said, you hear that, kid? We're almost home. Now walk tall. And, you know, it's a little scary because Martinson is barely conscious, but he's still holding the gun.
Yeah.
You know, and presumably it's got ammo in it. Like, you're a little scared of somebody waving this gun around. And then there's this marvelous bit of physical comedy on Jamie Farr's part where he tells Martinson, you know, come on, come behind me, hut, hut, hut. And then he walks out and we see that in the intervening steps, Martinson has obviously collapsed because he's no longer behind Klinger, but Klinger doesn't know that. And he's standing there and he's like, you know, he could go, you know, he could fire at any second. And then he notices that nobody's behind him. And Jamie Farr has this great bit where he goes, wait a minute, I'll be right back. And he points to the sky for some reason I don't understand, but it makes me laugh so hard. It's like it's very like Abbott and Costello, you know, just this kind of, wait a minute, I'll be right back. I just absolutely love it. And not to say that Jamie Farr wasn't always great on this show, because he was, but as we have delineated in previous episodes, Radar's not in this season very much. Gary Berghoff was getting ready to leave the show, and he wasn't in it very much. This is the one of the rare ones that he's in, but of course that means a lot of those kind of Corman plot lines go to Klinger.
Yeah.
And I feel like Jamie Farr kind of knew that. He sensed it and was like, all right, now I'm going to like really bring it, because here's my chance to shine, because I'm not playing second fiddle to the other Corman character, the other corporal. I'm kind of the main guy here. And he's really, really funny. He's very, very good. There's a lot of some great dramatics this season as well. He's just terrific this year.
Oh, I love him and everything. But yeah, I agree. And also he has a nice character arc too throughout the rest of this show, because he starts to drop that kind of facade of like the Section 8 thing and stuff as it moves towards the end. And I think he changes a lot, and he carries that change really well and really realistically throughout the rest of the series.
Absolutely. He's so fine. Again, the very next episode after this will be the one where he finds out that he's getting his wife cheating on him over the mail. I mean, so he gets a lot to do, but there's just something about that's such a weird comedy choice to point to the sky for no good reason. It just makes me laugh. So like, wait a minute, I'll be right back. It's so 40s. Kind of thing. Martinson collapses and they realize, okay, you know, we got to bandage him up and they'll deal with him. And then we cut to the lab and we see Hawkeye is examining and he's kind of letting Margaret twist in the wind a little bit. And he's like, and the winner is, and then he finally says negative. And she says, negative. Congratulations. You're still a major. And he says, can I tell you something? I'm a little disappointed. And he says, I'm glad you turned out the way you wanted it to. And she says, so am I. And he says, but at the same time, I'm also sorry. And she is able enough, close enough to Hawkeye to say, so am I. And we realize that some part of her wanted this, despite all of her protestations. Yeah. She's still sorry. And it's a great little beat to end the main episode on.
I agree. Yeah, I really like the ending. It's really sweet, and bittersweet is probably a better word. Yeah, it's a really interesting episode because it does kind of, I feel like the Martinson stuff gets a little crazy at the end because Klinger takes over and he's very funny and stuff. But like, there's a lot of serious stuff happening, and then it kind of like maintains sort of that drama aspect at the very, very end, even though they did all these ridiculous things to get to the final answer she needs. I like the way it kind of like hits you. This is a lot of stuff that kind of hits me in the heart in this episode, because you really feel it, like that kind of bittersweetness that she's having.
Absolutely. It's a terrific ending. So then for the button scene, Radar is bandaging up Fluffy. I love that he's wearing a lab coat, which is for no good reason. Like, he's kind of like, you know, this is him in his doctor mode as he's being veterinarian to Fluffy. And Margaret comes in. Margaret is wearing a MASH 477 sweatshirt, which I really want. I want one of those. I have not been able to like find them anywhere. I guess probably like on TeePublic or something. But I've always loved it. She wears them occasionally, and I just want to have a MASH 477 sweatshirt. I think they should have made those and sold them. And so they talk for a little bit, and this is kind of a rare moment, because usually Margaret, in any scene with just Radar, she's belittling him. She's yelling at him. She's calling him a twerp. She's ordering him around. But here, she's genial and she's nice. And she tells Radar that she appreciates what he and Fluffy did for her. And it's really sweet. And Radar gently brings up, you're not. And she's like, no, just a little gallbladder trouble. But she's like, I really appreciate what you did. And, and he says, that's okay, ma'am. I know you would have done the same for Fluffy.
Yeah, I love that.
It's really sweet. We hardly ever see Radar and Margaret being chummy. That never happens. But in this moment, Radar is kind of the authority, because he's the one who handed over the bunny. And it's a terrific, sweet ending for a great show.
It also shows how much she's grown too, you know, that she can like have that moment with him. you know, and tell somebody mm-hmm. that she appreciates what they've done. And like, I don't think the old Margaret would have ever done that.
So, absolutely. Yeah. It's really, really sweet. So I mentioned at the top of the show, this episode was directed by George Tyne. He did a bunch of MASHs. We've talked about him already. It was written by Larry Balmazia. This is his first script for MASH. He would become a story editor for the show in season 7, and he would have his name on a great many scripts. So great start, Larry Balmazia. Yeah, this is a terrific first script. He had other credits. He wrote on Barney Miller, Rhoda, mm-hmm. the Jeffersons, and then he later became a producer on Cheers and Wings.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, he had.
Oh, I know who that is because I'm a huge Cheers fan. Yeah, I recognize that name.
Yeah,
for sure.
Great, great TV career, obviously. So,
yeah.
But yeah, a terrific first script, you know, just an absolutely dynamite episode. So, before we get to the favorite line or joke from this episode, I'm going to tell a very brief story about how this episode was instrumental in teaching me a bitter life lesson when I was a child. So you don't mind, Amanda, I will
yes,
share this story. So, you know, I watched MASH when it aired originally, and then I watched it incessantly in reruns. I was a weird kid because, you know, I'm watching a show set in the 50s about war. But anyway, I was in fifth or sixth grade, and there was a kid in my class named Sean who was a naturally outgoing, charming kid. And he looked like a kid version of like Austin Butler, you know, like a good looking kid. And he was very popular. And I was a quiet kid and very, you know, very shy. And so, you know, that very two very different, you know, school careers are happening there at the same time. So anyway, at one point we were talking, me and another kid and this kid, Sean, were talking about, there was something had come up in class about pregnancy. I forget what it was. But anyway, I had seen this episode and I ventured the thing. I said, oh, well, the way they test for pregnancies is they tested on bunny rabbits, which is right, which is, you know, leaving some information out, but factually correct. And he misheard me, misunderstood, and was like, are you saying they make, and he said something like, are you saying that like they make bunnies get pregnant for people? And I was like, no, that's not what I'm saying. And then he literally turned to the whole class and pointed at me and started saying, this guy thinks they make bunny rabbits get pregnant. And he dunked on me in front of everybody.
Oh,
and this huge round of children were laughing at me.
Oh, that's
and
awful.
Not only, I mean, that sucked by itself, but it doubly sucked because I knew I was right. I was like, no, I know I'm right because I watched MASH, but it didn't matter because this kid was popular and was very comfortable holding court in front of the whole class when I never would have done that. You know what I mean? If the situation had been reversed, I would have never been like, hey, everybody, because I would never have engaged like that. But he felt comfortable like that. And like, I remember all these kids were making fun of me like the whole day because they thought I was an absolute idiot thinking that bunny rabbits had anything to do with being pregnant.
Oh my gosh. That's a kinder trauma.
It really is a kinder trauma. It taught me very early on that if you're confident and you're charming, you can go a long way and it doesn't matter whether you're right or not. And that's pretty much been, you know, I think that's true of, that's still true to this day, obviously. You can get pretty far just being confident, even if you're an idiot. But you know, I still felt I was right because MASH taught me something. So there we go.
I kind of feel like you, the way you said it earlier, I wanted it on a t-shirt. You said something like, I know I'm right because I saw it on MASH. And I feel like that should be a t-shirt.
That would be a great shirt in the stencil font and everything. That would be terrific. Yeah, that we'll have to think about that. Put it on a mug or something. So that's my sad, bitter story from fifth or sixth grade related to this episode. So
sixth grade's hard on a lot of us.
Sure is. It sure is. So anyway, I had to tell that story because when else is it ever going to come up? So regarding this episode, Amanda, do you have a favorite joke or line from the show?
Yeah, I worked on a couple. So one is, and they're almost like just throwaway lines, but they made me laugh so hard. One is where Hawkeye's looking, I think, through the magnifying glass at the ovaries. And he says something like, oh my God, I can't believe it. And Margaret's like, what? And he's like, I didn't know my thumb was this big, which is great. And maybe a little mean to her because clearly She's waiting for an answer. Yeah. But I the way he says it is just so funny. And then also Radar has that great line when he finds out that Margaret's pregnant and he says, "You're going to be a mother, sir," which is, I think, adorable. And I just, one of my favorite moments in the episode.
It's a great moment for Radar. He, like I mentioned, he wasn't in the season much, but when he was in one, they gave him a lot to do. You know, I think Gary Berghoff is sort of like, if I'm going to be here, I want to get a lot to do. And so there's only the handful of shows that Radar's in, but he's front and center on it. And this is, it's a terrific one for him. And I can't peg the idea that like Radar was so keen to animals that had anything to do with my later vegetarianism, but I have to think it was an influence on some level that I just responded to that Radar's love of animals helped lead me to that decision 25 years ago. So,
that's fantastic. You know, I'm a vegetarian too. I didn't know.
I did not know that.
Yeah. I've been one since I was a teenager, but I became a vegetarian because I was a huge fan of Howard Jones. And he actually was he still is a huge vegetarian, but he actually wrote some music about it. And he wrote this song, which he performed live last time I saw him. And of course, now I can't remember the name of it. But it's got this line that's something like farmyard, children talk about their farmyard favorites on the table in a different disguise.
Mm.
And that really struck me when I was like 14, whenever that album came out, that big album he had. And I was already leaning towards it, like being a vegetarian. And so the year after that, I was 15, and I actually remember, like, it was in October, maybe it was because my last meal with meat was at Arby's that I decided to reject meat, but that's what happened. And I actually remember saying to my dad, I said, "I don't ever want to eat meat again." And I just stopped. And my parents were actually surprisingly supportive of it. And they worked around it for me till I was old enough to make my own meals and like buy a shop and do all that stuff. But, and I never looked back and I've been really happy with it.
That was really hard to do. I mean, I've been a vegetarian for 25 years. So you're talking 1998, and that was hard because there was not a lot of options for.
No, there wasn't.
You go back even further than that. That was even doubly harder for you.
You know, those hamburger helper meals, my parents would just make like hamburger helper without the hamburger and then serve it to me and then put the hamburger in it. Like, so
aww, that's
like,
nice.
And those are not healthy meals, but like they would try to like work around. Even when I was little, like, I would, try to hide meat, but I'd eat all my veggies.
And the inverse.
They were so perplexed because they were big meat eaters. And that's probably why too, because they fed me all kinds of gross meat. Let's face it. Like kidneys and liver and like, it was not typical meat in my house. And so that was also part of it. And I kind of felt like that when I became vegetarian, they were like, "I think we drove her to it. So we should be really supportive of it." So
that's sweet though. That's great. That's awesome that you didn't get any grief about it. Cause some people don't handle it super well. And I don't proselytize, you know what I mean? Like I don't tell people. I mean, you just talked about it. You didn't know. You and I have been friends for many years. It's never come up to this point because it's not something I really bring up, but I have to think between Radar and like Lisa Simpson, it probably there's some connection, to that eventual move. But yeah, boy, being a vegetarian pre, the Impossible Burgers and pre all the other tofu, tough to find meals anywhere.
Absolutely.
Taco
Bell.
Yeah, that's right. So, well, awesome. Well, okay. I got to do my favorite line. I forgot. I was so involved in my vegetarian discussion. So, it's when, Martinson talks about that he's, highly educated. He doesn't present it that way, but he just talks about that he's got a lot of schooling, and that's why he's become an automatic lieutenant. And BJ says, "What kind of education do you have?" And Martinson knows how ridiculous this sounds, and he kind of says it sort of embarrassed, and he goes, "Art history. I was an art history major." And BJ is not really he's not really quite perceiving how edgy Martinson is. And he responds with a joke and he goes, "I think the Marines are the only ones with an art history division."
That's right. I remember that. Yeah.
Which is a great joke, but it's like, not right now, BJ. This guy's not in the mood for your jokes about that. But I just love the idea that the Marines have an art history division, but it's a great gag. So it's a terrific episode. It's one of the highlights of season 6. And I was so thrilled as always. Amanda, to talk to you for any reason is always a blast. So thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, thank you. I really, really loved it. And thank you for letting me do this episode. Every time you ask me to pick an episode, I somehow fall in love with it all over again. So
that's been great. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
I guess the best place to find me is just look up Made for TV Mayhem. That's my Twitter handle. That's where you'll find my Facebook page and my Instagram.
All right. Sounds good. Of course, everybody, you can find this show over on Twitter at MASH477Cast. All the Beck episodes are on our website, FineWaterPodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any of the major podcasting platforms. And if you want to support Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big salute to Danny Ulrich, Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Mike Thomas, Joe Perino, Billy Shulman, Dennis Bailey, Kara Kay, Tim English, Adam Ackerman, Lisa P, Laura Braun, Stephen Van Skyke, Michael Kelly, and Daryl Clark. Billy's appreciate the support. So we will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
What made you so sure?
I have all the symptoms, morning sickness, nausea.
We all have that, from the mesh tent takeout window.
There's more. I've been irritable lately.
Well, if you count irritability, you've been pregnant since I've known you.